This episode contains explicit language.
In order for a black person to cross the threshold to walk into a space, there has to be signals that says you're welcome.
Every restaurant sends signals, codes that tell you what kind of place it is and whether it's for you. Of course, there's the food and the decor, but then there's codes like the other customers.
What is on your mind when you can't go into a restaurant when there are people that don't look like you?
This is part two of our series, Who Is This Restaurant For? It's a look at all the signals we receive when we walk into a place and what they can tell us about our perceptions of race and culture. Yesterday, in part one, we visited three restaurants in Washington, D.C. that send very different signals to attract their target customers.
I said, I don't want you ever to be blind to race. When you see a table walk in, racialize them immediately.
We asked the question, can you make a restaurant for everyone? And if you could, is that even what people want?
I travel the country enough to know a lot of people absolutely don't want that. They're looking for a place where they feel comfortable, and for a large percentage of this country, comfortable means people who look like me, act like me, and smell like me.
Today, we're going to ask a different question. What do the people working in a restaurant look like? And what judgments does that lead us to make about the food?
If you go to an Asian restaurant, the expectation of authenticity is that the servers should be Asian-ish.
We'll hear from a Chinese-American who worked as a sushi chef in a place where just about every customer assumed he was Japanese.
Like, I was performing my ethnicity to a certain extent. It didn't make me beam with pride.
And we'll hear from an Indian-American who ran an Italian butcher shop.
One of the customers had said, what, is Cal putting curry powder in the marinade now?
If you want people to like your restaurant, how important is it to look the part? We'll discuss. Stick around. WNYC Studios, this is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman. Each week on our show, we obsess about food to learn more about people. This is part two of our series, Who Is This Restaurant For? If you missed part one, you don't have to hear it to understand this episode, but I do recommend starting the series from the beginning. Now, the first time I interviewed Ken Lin, he was in character as Hong Kong Fever, frontman for the satirical rap metal group Notorious MSG.
On the frying pan, a sexy man, I put my egg roll in your hand.
Hot and strong, I'm a looking real good. I see myself in a pump wood.
Notorious MSG caricatures Asian stereotypes while singing songs like Straight Outta Canton, Dim Sum Girl, and this one, Shanghai Superfly.
Smoking your ass up like a hot shoe mine.
Love is the back is stuck when the Chinatown pins coming down your throat.
When I interviewed Ken a couple years ago, it was for a Lunar New Year episode that we did. In character as Hong Kong Fever, he talked like this.
We work in Chinese, whatever place would take us, you know, Chinese restaurant, I work in a pizza place, made the sushi sometime.
But when I sat down with him recently...
Sure, my parents were Asian, but I just wanted to fit in with everybody, and I just wanted to just be included with everything.
Ken grew up in New Jersey. He's Chinese-American. These days, he works as a web video producer when he's not having fun with Notorious MSG. I wanted to talk to him about his experience making sushi years ago in a Japanese restaurant. But before we got to that, he told me about one of his earlier high school jobs, making pizza at Little Caesars.
I would take the dough, feed it through the mashing machine, that thing that mashes the dough.
Ken, slow down with all these technical terms.
Yeah, it's like, sorry, you guys.
I'm not a professional pizza chef.
It's technically the mashing dough machine, right?
Okay.
Yeah, I would stick it through there and then grab that and put it in the black tray, the metal thing. And
right.
Then,
the pan.
Yeah, put it in the pan.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You're more advanced than
See,
you're letting
that's
on.
That's why I'm the host of the show, Ken, because I know these big words, these advanced terms.
In the pan, and then you just chuck it on the conveyor belt thing,
right.
that oven conveyor belt.
Right.
Thing
it's sort of like the idiot-proof pizza cooking machine.
Right. Right.
Right. So tell me how you came to be working at a Japanese restaurant.
It was the year before I went to college, and I was 17, and I just needed a job to kind of make it through a few months. And I saw the ad in the paper, because back then it was like, you know, looking through the want ads and whatnot. And I was like, oh, I got this one. I was like, I totally got it. I'm Asian, and it's a sushi restaurant. I was pretty confident that I'd nail this one. I had no qualifications. So I walked in, and sure enough, they hired me like on the spot, just because being Asian, you know, you do want that association, because people tend to associate that with authenticity.
Set the scene for me of this restaurant.
It was like a teriyaki boy, if I could make comparison to it. It was like that tier of restaurant where, you know, you can get a few things to go, like pre-made California rolls, and then those little hand rolls. Which
right,
called,
sort of the cone-shaped ones.
The cone-shaped, which are the hand rolls, and then also the unis? What are they called? Ebi. Ebi? Shit, man. I'm such a, like, I definitely didn't deserve that job. The ones that look, the little ones that go in your hand where you have to kind of, I just remember having to squeeze them in my hand.
Right,
and, like,
right.
Because they're like
the
tiny little cylindrical.
The individual pieces.
Yeah.
Right. So describe the customers.
Okay, probably like one Asian American would come every like other week. It was like 99% white. It was suburban, you know? And so you would get a lot of like families, people coming to and from work. Occasionally somebody from my high school would drop by and I would be, you know, mortified, wanting to end my life immediately. And I had to wear this little, like, robe kimono thing.
Do you remember the first time you put that uniform on?
It felt a little bit like a chicken outfit, like, or having to wear one of those sandwich boards or something. It didn't make me beam with pride. I would take it off immediately after I left. You know, this felt like disingenuous kind of Asian representation happening. Like, I was performing my ethnicity to a certain extent, which was strange to me.
You're working in the sushi restaurant. General customers come in. They're almost all white suburban folks. Were you aware at that age that they probably mostly assumed you were Japanese American?
Yeah, totally.
How did you feel knowing that they were making that incorrect assumption about you?
As sad as it is, I was kind of used to it at that point already, because you grow up with the, you know, the Chinese, Japanese, dirty knees, look at these. So, which is a really catchy rhyme, I have to say.
It's like that, or make it in any of your songs?
I'm working on it. It's got to be the right beat, you know? But anyway, but it was sort of like, okay, that kind of gave me a sense of like, oh, nobody gives a damn about like what ethnicity I am. I didn't feel like I needed to make a distinction for them. Not that I didn't want them to care. I think they just lump it into one, like, let's just make it some, like, Ching Chong Festival, Kung Fu Font, Panda Garden thing, you know?
Right.
And my peeps do it, too. They know that it'll sell to the lowest common denominator.
It's interesting to me because I live pretty far outside the city, sort of like on the border between the suburbs and the country.
Mm-hmm.
And recently a new supermarket opened up that is trying to be like a little more high-end, a little more sort of local organic-ish, and they have a sushi counter, and there's a guy there making sushi. Now, I am not informed enough to say with certainty what this gentleman's background is, but I'm pretty sure he doesn't look Japanese to my relatively uninformed eyes, okay? But he's wearing that outfit.
Right.
And now this is a supermarket. Every person working in the supermarket is white.
Yeah.
Every customer is white.
Hmm.
And they got one guy at the sushi counter who is vaguely Asian in appearance, wearing this uniform, the sushi chef uniform.
Yeah.
And it felt... It made me feel a little uncomfortable.
Yeah,
to be honest.
It's a bit exploitative. I feel like it's when you have that, and especially when it doesn't apply to anybody else.
So when you go into a sushi restaurant today, and you see that the people making the sushi are not Japanese, they're Asian American, yeah. but you are able to see that they're not Japanese. What judgments do you make about the food at that place?
Look, I'm going to be totally honest with you. Like, there's a side of me, there's this academia would say that you should disregard the person's ethnicity and not pay it. Every person has the capability of making great food regardless of where their background. But the realist in me says, no, they just probably pick this up just so they can open this restaurant, and the sushi is probably lousy.
Later in this show, I'll talk with Professor Krishnendu Ray about a lot of these dynamics. But there's one thing he told me that I want to mention right here. The best way to tell who's making your sushi is actually to look at the prices. He says in America today, only the most high-end places have Japanese chefs because Japanese workers get paid more. As for Ken, that job he had in high school, that was 25 years ago. He's 42 now. But the experience had a real impact on him.
Your sense of identity at 17 is already kind of still forming. And it's confusing sometimes when you're put in a position like that, especially being Asian. And you're suddenly, well, like, is this how I'm seen to others? Is this how I need to present myself? Or is this how the only way I'm going to be accepted? Which is sort of why I created the band that I have. It's so I could perform it in the way that feels interesting and honest to me. You have to be able to tell your own story and not have others tell it for you is pretty much why I formed the band.
That's Ken Lin. By day, he's a web video producer. By night, he is Hong Kong Fever, frontman for the satirical rap metal group Notorious MSG. And those guys haven't released any music in a while, but Ken tells me they are about to drop a new single called Wanton Violence. Check their website for updates, notoriousmsg.com. So Ken got that job making sushi because he fit the part. But what happens when a restaurant worker breaks the mold? Cal Gulopalli worked on Wall Street for years, but he always wanted to get into the food business. He was bit by the bug in high school when he was an assistant manager at Little Caesars. Cal bought an Italian butcher shop in a town called Malvern on Long Island. It had been there for decades with the same owner. It had a regular group of Italian-American customers. And Cal was really drawn to that. He liked that history and the community of the place. Plus, even though he didn't know anything about butchering, he loved meat. And he thought it was a good business opportunity. But he knew it wouldn't be easy.
Being Indian American and not knowing anybody in this particular area, you know, I was scared. And this is part of, I think, human nature is, you know, people are inherently prejudiced. I think we all have it. I'll include myself in there. And when an Indian American, or just say any race, takes over a concept that should be or historically was run by someone of Italian descent, the first thing they're going to think is, wait, is he going to change this?
So Cal kept everything exactly the same. The food, the prices, the staff, which was mostly Italian American. He didn't add a pinch of salt that wasn't there before. The only thing different was him. Every so often, he'd sit down with his staff to hear what the customers were saying.
One of the customers had said, what, is Cal putting curry powder in the marinade now? So, you know, I obviously was taken aback and that hurt, but I guess it was initial prejudice that come out.
What did you do? How do you deal with that?
For me, it's a business, and, you know, it's a business that feeds my family. So at that point, you know, I need to figure out what should be my reaction so that I'm growing the business and not destroying it. So with that particular customer, I let it go.
And how aware do you think your customers in Malvern were that many Indians are Hindu and many Hindus don't eat meat?
I don't think that very many people are aware of that. There were people that came up to me and said that, wait, aren't you not supposed to be eating red meat? And my response to that is, look, I am born and raised American. I grew up eating meat my entire life. You know, this is just who I am.
Cal thought that as long as customers kept seeing him around the store, they'd remain skeptical. So he decided to make a change.
Inherently, I'm not a front of the house guy. I'm more of a behind the scenes guy. But I also know that the business is better off with me in the back.
So Cal mostly stayed out of sight. And over the time he owned the business, it did pretty well. The number of customers went down, but the average customer spent more. So it kind of balanced out. Cal earned a living from the place, and after 2 years, he sold it at a profit. And the reason he sold was mainly that his wife got a new job, and they moved to a town called Woburn, Massachusetts, outside Boston. Once they got there, Cal bought a pizzeria.
My investment thesis was now, let's buy something where the owner is not so well-known or has such a strong presence in the business. What also helped was the owner of Lisa's Pizzeria Woburn was not Italian. So it gave me a lot more comfort that even if I had to be in the front, I would be okay.
What did your parents think? You know, you must have reported back to them about some of the difficulties in the butcher shop when you moved up to Boston and decided to buy a pizzeria. What did your parents say?
Well, they always wanted me to become a doctor, and once they realized that I wasn't going to be it, they just said, okay, you're on your own, do your thing.
Right. I guess to them there's no difference between owning a butcher shop or a pizzeria or an Indian restaurant.
Yeah, actually, so owning a pizzeria in their eyes is much better because I'm not necessarily in 100% in the meat business, and I eat everything. My mom does not eat red meat. My father does, but just the perception in the Indian community of telling their friends that my son owns butcher shops was not the proudest thing to say.
Right. It's like a Jewish parent having to tell people that their kid is, you know, selling bacon or something.
So my mom would tell people, oh, he owns a deli.
Pretty soon, though, Cal's parents would have more explaining to do to their friends. A year after buying the pizzeria, he opened his own burger place called Woo Burger. It's in the vein of fast casual places like Smash Burger, Five Guys, and Shake Shack. Cal says so far, it's been pretty different from the butcher shop. For one thing, he already owned the pizzeria in town, so a lot of folks knew him. It's not like he was the new guy coming in. But he still mostly stays behind the scenes.
In the butcher shops, it was more of a worry because I couldn't hide that much. I tried to, no doubt, but as we grow into fast casual concepts, you don't see the owners as much. And so, you know, you could argue that I gravitated towards fast casual for that reason. So it's just one less worry. And I can just focus on what I need to focus on, which is, you know, operations and finance. You know, I'm sure, again, there's prejudices, but the business is doing very well. And we're really happy with, we just had our 1 year birthday last week.
That's Cal Gulapalli. He owns Lisa's Pizzeria and Woo Burger, both in Woburn, Mass., and Woo Burger Gourmet in Cambridge. Now, let's zoom out just a little bit. How common are Cal and Ken's experiences? And is this just plain old prejudice, or is it more complicated? Professor Krishnendu Ray is chair of the Food Studies Department at NYU and author of the book The Ethnic Restaurateur. He says Ken was right to think that being Asian would help him get that sushi job.
I think he was right to make that judgment because that's the expectation of a largely white audience who would think that having sushi made by an Asian-looking guy is more authentic than having sushi by an African-American-looking guy or a white guy.
And do you think, as a general matter, sushi places in America understand that and hire on that basis?
Absolutely, they do. And in fact, I'm surprised that we haven't had more legal cases because technically, you cannot make visible ethnicity a criteria of employment unless it has something to do with the job. We generally don't see too many cases about it simply because no one wants to fight for these very low-end jobs.
I'm especially interested in this, in the sushi chef job because it is a food prep cooking job, but it's often in the front of the house. The customers can see the person who's making the sushi. And I'm also interested in the what I'll call the sushi chef uniform that they almost invariably wear. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, is there a certain point at which if restaurants are hiring a person because they look, to use your term, vaguely Asian-ish, and then they're putting this outfit on them and sort of putting them out in front of the customers to create a certain impression, at what point has it crossed into exploitation?
Identity is partly performance. You are what you appear to be. And this violates at least this Western American romantic notion. You are what's in your soul, what you're deeply inside, what your roots are. In fact, performance is as important as questions of identity and rootedness. Putting on that sushi attire in some ways is getting on the performance of being a sushi chef. And in this case is a lovely example of a performance of being an Asian allows him some access to a resource, in this case, a job.
Professor Ray says there are other examples of this kind of play acting in restaurants. Bangladeshis and Pakistanis running Indian restaurants, Salvadorans doing Mexican food, Cambodians doing Vietnamese food. Mostly, it's a business decision. They go with cuisines that Americans are more familiar with, and to most Americans, they look the part. So we prefer it when the people we see working in a restaurant look like the people we associate with the food. And Professor Ray admits he has the same preference. His favorite ramen shop in New York is owned by a Japanese guy. The servers are Japanese, but the cooks are Nepali. First time he went there, he was skeptical.
I said, how good could it be if all the cooks are Nepali? I kept an open mind.
Right.
Then I started eating, and I have eaten there last decade, and I love it.
Right.
And so it is also reminds me of kitchen skills can be learned across racial barriers.
Right.
I would have preferred if all the staff, all the kitchen staff were Japanese in that place. But then I know the economics of it. That is impossible because to get Japanese cooks, we have to pay them Japanese city wages.
You'd have to charge $40 for a bowl of ramen.
Exactly. Right. Or even more, I think.
Professor Ray says our preference that the workers appear to match the food is fine to a point. After all, it's based on a reasonable assumption. On average, he says, Japanese people are better at cooking Japanese food. They have more experience, more exposure. It only becomes prejudice when you say that non-Japanese can't cook good Japanese food, period, no matter their experience or training. Now, as we've said, a lot of us make judgments based not only on the people working in a restaurant, but also on the people eating there. I told Professor Ray about a recent meal I had at an Indian restaurant where all the customers were white.
I can be honest that when I saw the customers at this place, I thought to myself, like, even if the people who work back there are capable of making great Indian food, they're not going to serve it to me. I made judgments.
Uh-huh.
And I'm Jewish. I grew up going to Chinese restaurants all the time. There's always a thing that Jewish people would joke about. Don't go to a Chinese restaurant if it's only other Jewish people there. That's how you know which are the good ones. Yeah. Look for the Chinese people. So I do feel like that's a judgment that we all make.
But I think it's absolutely fine. Because we cannot know everything about everyone in every situation before we interact with them. We depend on all kinds of cues. Who else is eating? Who is cooking? Who is serving? And that's absolutely fine and reasonable judgment to make as long as we are open-minded about it, that to change our mind as new facts emerge.
That's Professor Krishnendu Ray, chair of the NYU Food Studies Department and author of The Ethnic Restaurateur. And that's it for part two of our series, Who Is This Restaurant For? Tomorrow, the conversation continues. Chef Amanda Cohen of Dirt Candy tells us what restaurant codes she objects to as a woman.
The other thing that really puts me off a restaurant is if the female servers are in a uniform that is different than the male uniform, and if it's particularly sexy.
And a Middle Eastern restaurant owner named Hassan Diab discusses the challenges of sending the right signals in a diverse neighborhood.
A lot of the Middle Eastern guys comes and they think that I'm Israeli, so they don't like me much. And a lot of the Israelis also come and think that I'm an Arab, so they don't like me as much.
Plus, Chef So-hee Kim talks about trying to appeal to both hipsters and old-school Koreans.
Because it's not in the brightly lit fluorescent served by surly middle-aged Korean woman. It's just, we're just under attack.
Then, coming up Thursday in the conclusion of our series, my conversation with comedian W. Kamau Bell.
the more mixed a place is, the better I feel about it. Because we live in Berkeley, and Berkeley's much whiter than Oakland. And so sometimes if we're going to Oakland, I'm like, oh, yeah, like we're gonna be able to disappear.
That's Thursday. Please make sure you subscribe to this podcast wherever you get it. That way, you'll never miss an episode. Go ahead and subscribe right now while you're listening. Thanks. This show is a production of WNYC Studios and The Sporkful. It's produced by Ann Sani and me. Editing help from Shoshana Gold, Rebecca Carroll, Lee Hill, and Sue Yaka. Engineering help from Chase Culpin and Irene Trudell. Music help from Black Label Music. Special thanks to Paula Schumann. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
And I'm Ari Strauss from Washington, D.C., reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.